Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, welcome to another moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And I'm going to try to power through this one. And on the other side of the break, I'll tell you why I am powering through. But I just wanted to go ahead and get this show started. So now, here is Grace G with a moment of news.
Thanks, Eric. Violence escalated in the Middle East as Hamas militants killed more than 1,200 Israelis, 22 Americans, and took at least 150 hostages, leading to retaliatory strikes from Israel's defense forces, resulting in over 1,100 deaths in Gaza. Western countries, led by the United States, denounced the Hamas attack. The House Republican Conference nominated Representative Steve Scalise to succeed U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who was recently ousted. Scalise faced competition from Representative Jim Jordan, who was endorsed by Donald Trump. 75,000 unionized healthcare workers at Kaiser Permanente held a 72-hour strike over issues of staffing shortages and pay. This was the largest strike ever in the U.S. healthcare sector. Arizona Republican Carrie Lake announced her candidacy for the U.S. Senate in 2024, challenging incumbent Senator Kyrsten Sinema. Students for Fair Admissions, a group opposing affirmative action, has sued the U.S. Naval Academy following a similar case against the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. California Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a bill that would have banned race discrimination, citing existing laws covering ancestry discrimination. 6 Georgia state troopers will not face charges following the shooting death of a protester, Manuel Paez Turan, at a police training center construction site, nicknamed Cop City by opponents. A federal judge in Oklahoma has allowed a state law banning gender-affirming care for transgender minors to take effect, despite major U.S. medical associations advocating for such treatments. The wealthiest Americans are coming out of the pandemic with their share of wealth and income rising, despite initial expectations of a reduction in wealth inequality. And Hughes Van Ellis, one of the last 3 known survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, died at the age of 102. I am Grace G, and this has been A Moment of News.
All right, thank you, Grace, for that news. And as you know, we kind of pre-record stuff, so just some updates of where we are based on what you've heard in the news break is that
we've had over 1,300 Israelis that have been killed in the attack started by Hamas or Hamas. And now it's around 2,000, a little over 2,000 Palestinians that have been killed in the bombings of Gaza. And so this is escalating, you know, as I'm recording this. The Israeli Defense Forces are going to have a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip. And that's going to prolong this and may even bring in other elements like Hezbollah from Lebanon and whoever else. So this is unfortunately just the start. And hopefully, through outside negotiations and just a sheer will to continue to fight, that this won't be prolonged much longer. But it's not going to be as quick as we would like it to be. So that's one thing. The other thing that has been fluid from when we recorded the news segment is that Steve Scalise is not going to be the next speaker. He's pulled his name from consideration. And Jim Jordan now has ascended to the front, but it looks like there's even more opposition to him being speaker within the Republican ranks than there was for Scalise. And I'm going to get into that a little bit later, because I just got some takes. I don't know how long I'm going to do this particular episode, because maybe you can tell, but my voice is kind of worn out. That's because I went to homecoming. Shout out to Jackson State University. I went to our homecoming. And as far as the festivities and getting to see old classmates and friends in the city of Jackson, it was cool, you know. It was good to go home, because I consider Jackson my second home. Chicago's my birthplace home, but Jackson's my second home. So it was really good to see people and bump into them, and some people hadn't seen in a little while. You know how it goes. Kind of like how it was for when I told you I went to my reunion. Or if you follow me on the socials, you know I went to my 40th high school reunion too. Didn't lose my voice in that one, but did lose a voice. And unfortunately, my alma mater didn't win the football game, but still a good time, you know. And but the thing that kind of upsets me, and I wanted to put it on the record, is looking at Jackson, Mississippi, and this is now, we've been removed from the water crisis. They're in the midst of their statewide elections. You know, I just think it's an awful tragedy that people who really want to invest in things. And again, I'm not in business. I don't understand all that stuff. I got into politics to try to figure out how to make it fair for everybody to participate in business and to get a share of the wealth that's available in this nation. But when you have been away from a place that you live for like 34 years and then you step away and you come back, and even though I keep track of what's going on to a degree, to actually just look at it at a different lens, right, is just really, really sad to me that people who claim to be developers, people who claim to be economic opportunists or venture capitalists or whatever, you know, just don't do anything for Mississippi. They don't do anything for the capital city of Mississippi. And I have a theory behind that, and I may be wrong, but it seems like capitalism ties in with racism inextricably. I think when you have a city that's 85% black, in any city in the United States, it's 85% black. The capitalist formula is that that's not a place where people can make money. That's not a place where you want to put new development in. You don't want to support upgrading the infrastructure, hence the water crisis. You know, it just seemed like, well, you know, the black folks in charge, so let them handle it. You know, let them do what they want to do. And so being here in Atlanta now, you know, people will claim that Atlanta is a black city. And you see all this investment, all this, you know, growth. It's like if there's a patch of grass that's out there, somebody's going to literally get a permit to build 15-story apartment complex or condo complex there, right? Just constant, constant growth, or at least in the project sense. Because the haves and the have-nots in Atlanta are divided more so than any other place in the nation. And you can feel it. If you're not one of the haves, you can feel it here. But you go to Jackson, and it just seems as though that there is so much potential to do a lot of things that they're all trying to cram in Atlanta. These folks could go to Jackson, Mississippi and make a killing. But Atlanta is not really a black city. It's just kind of barely, like 54%, right? In the outlying areas, it varies, because you go south, it's predominantly black. You go north, it's predominantly white, as far as Fulton County is concerned. And so you see development north of, in the northern part of Fulton County, north of Atlanta. And you see some development south, primarily because the airport is south, right? And if the airport wasn't on the south, southern part of the county, who knows what would happen down here, right? So those places are seeing more development and more, at least, inquiries and, you know, ideas being thrown out there. Whether the elected officials in those cities support those ideas or not, that's a whole nother conversation. But at least the ideas are coming. In Jackson, it's not really happening. You know, in the early 2000s, there was interest. Katrina happened. So there was money available to make that happen. Me being in the legislature, you know, we passed for tax credits. You know, we created historical preservation tax credits. And, you know, we had tax credits, not to the extent that they do it in Florida, in Georgia. But we had a very friendly tax incentive program for the film industry in Mississippi. And we were doing those things to boost the state up, you know. And the state finally surrendered and got a lottery, but, you know, I'm just saying, usually lottery funds supplement education. So what's going to supplement business growth and development? Why is Mississippi, and especially Jackson, not a place where you want to do business? It's the poorest state in the nation, which means that it has the lowest cost of living in the nation. Which means that you don't have to pay people as much, although you should. You don't have to pay people as much as you do people in Atlanta, right? But, like I said, you should. And if you did, you would see a tremendous upswing. Jackson has everything that is needed to be that kind of city. I mean, you have two interstates run through there. You have colleges, universities there. You know, you got law school, medical center, medical school. You know, you've got stuff there. And, you know, it's the potential is there. Now, a lot of development in Mississippi happens on the Gulf Coast because, you know, it's by the water and people are attracted to it and all that stuff. But Katrina is a reminder that all those billions of dollars of investments can be wiped away within like 24 hours. Jackson's pretty much landlocked except for the Pearl River. You could do that kind of stuff if you could get racism out of capitalism. Right? And that's the reason why it's more important for Black politicians to not concentrate on personal wealth, but concentrate on community wealth so that we'd have more Black investors to invest in places like Jackson instead of depending on the benevolence of white capitalists to see what potential is out there and doing something with it. You know, the old adage from the movie Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. There's some truth to that. And I just think that if you can get the racism out of capitalism, Jackson, Mississippi would be a tremendous, tremendous jewel in the South. The potential is there. And it's almost like I was telling one of my friends during the festivities homecoming, I look at Jackson as a blank canvas that somebody or groups of people can go in and just remake the visual of the city, remake the image of the city. Not to the point, of course, we want to push the Black folks out. Right, because that's the other thing. You know, this big word, gentrification. It's this pattern where, well, the only way we can make this city viable is that we got to attract the white people back. Right? they moved out because they didn't want to be around black folks. So why should the black folks suffer because the white folks are selfish and racist and don't want to live amongst black people? Black people should have nice things too. You know, one of the richest black subdivisions in the state of Mississippi is in Jackson. And it's not just rich in a low curve for black folks. It's rich as far as statewide. And I know this because I had the privilege of representing these folks. Right? And so they deserve to have a city that is just as vibrant or just as progressive or just as hip or trendy or whatever term you want to use as Atlanta or Chicago or New York or Dallas or whatever. If you're looking for a place to develop, Jackson, Mississippi is that place. The stadium where my alma mater plays is literally 60 years old. And it wasn't built for them. The stadium was over a decade old before they even, I hate to say allow, but I think that's more of the correct term, to even play there. And then they gave it to them eventually. But, you know, it's, you know, one of the main development ideas is to build the stadium, a stadium on campus. And the campus kind of stretches out close to downtown anyway. So start by building a stadium for Jackson State University on Jackson State University's campus. And you can do it like these cities are doing with these pro teams. You can build apartments and hotels and whatever other amenities that you think would be tied into people coming to watch a football game, right? Especially at homecoming. I mean, you can get creative all you want to for Ole Miss and Mississippi State or Georgia State or University of Georgia, but you can't be creative, or Georgia Tech, but you can't be creative for Jackson State. I'm just saying, right? And so it's a call to arms for us as black people, that we have to take those skills and all that, and not all come to Atlanta, and not all come go to Houston, right? Or just D.C., whatever. Go to Mississippi and show what you can do. It's a blank canvas. And it's not saying that there's nothing there, right? There's museums and places to eat that are tremendous, and there's a nightlife and all that stuff, but oh my God, the potential to expand upon that foundation that's there and to have that imprint that black folks really did that would be tremendous. You know, if white people want to come back to Jackson once it starts being vibrant again, great. Nobody wants to permanently exclude them. But, you know, we don't really have time for white folks to decide to invest in the city again. We've got to do some things to make that happen. Part of the way that you do that is you got to change the political landscape in that Capitol building. The mindset of these people I literally watched the commercial. Well, we have a Democratic candidate. There's a Democratic candidate running for governor named Brandon Presley. Brandon is literally a cousin of Elvis Presley, right? He was mayor of a town, Nettleton. He's one of the longest serving public service commissioners in the history of the state. He decided to run for governor. He kind of looked like John Daly at one point in his life, and now he's lost the weight and he's gotten married. And now, oh, it's just, you know, and he's out there and he's running an effective race because you've gotten people that have been Republicans in Mississippi for a long time who are supporting him because they don't identify with Donald Trump. Right. And so Tate Reeves, who is the current governor, is running ads basically saying these people aren't real Republicans that are endorsing Mr. Presley because they don't like Donald Trump. And so that's going to kind of lead me into what I want to talk about in the second half, right? And I just think that's absolutely amazing to me. I'm like, if there's any state where you might want to listen to somebody that's not down with Donald Trump, it's probably Mississippi. Because Donald Trump hasn't rewarded Mississippi in any way, shape, or form. He never did when he was president. And all he's doing to Mississippians right now is taking their money to pay for his legal funds in Georgia, in New York, in D.C. That's it. He didn't do anything in 4 years for Mississippi when he was president, and he's not going to do anything again other than just try to recruit people to buy into his BS. I mean, that's just real talk. And, you know, these guys that, you know, were Republicans when I was involved in politics there. Yeah, a lot of them don't like Donald Trump. You know, some like Tate and Phil Bryant before him and all that started doing the chameleon thing and trying to act like they like Donald Trump so they could continue to boost their political careers. But the reality is, they know a hustler when they see one, especially from a big city. And traditionally, Mississippi folks never really got turned on by that. But because of this historically latent fear and the perpetual nagging nuance of racism that exists, right? They will go with the Republican Party, even with a guy like Donald Trump, because, well, you know, the Democrats are trying to help everybody, and they believe a lot of Democrats are trying to help everybody but white people, right? And I don't know why that is still an effective argument other than miseducation, but that's where we are. But you got to change the political landscape. You got to get a guy like a Brandon Presley in. You got to get some folks in some of these other positions like Secretary of State and all that to cleanse the palate. You got to change the dynamic of the legislature to cleanse the palate and allow people to get to this blank canvas called Jackson, Mississippi, and build it up. But as long as you have these folks who are broke, have a mindset, I'd rather be broke and racist than live abundantly as according to God's will, Mississippi's still going to be the poorest state in the nation. So it's really up to the people of the state of Mississippi to decide what they want their state to really look like and how far advanced do they want to become, right? I mean, everybody claps when we get something really nice to come, but they treat it as if, oh, it was a nice little reward we got instead of something that people deserve in Mississippi. You're citizens of the United States just like any of these other 50 states or 49 states. And if you count D.C., 50. You count Puerto Rico, 51, right? But it's like Mississippi deserves their seat at the table. But as long as you got people who don't know that they still at the kids' table and they trying to keep black folks and others from even sitting at the kids' table, then we'll never get to the big table to feast and build the state up the way it should be. And that's just me. You know, I'm just... Racism historically has always hurt progress in the United States. Despite all the things that the United States has attained, all I can imagine is if we weren't a racist nation, how far we would go, how further along we would be, how much more dominant we would be in the world stage. So I'm going to expand on that and talk about how this stuff is impacting us at a national and a international scale on the other side. All right, and we're back. So, and before I elaborate further on my points about what we're missing out on, let me just apologize to y'all because I know I may not sound as energetic or alert, kind of dragging a little bit. I literally got off the plane, got to the house, and realized that I had to, you know, get this episode out. So I apologize for that, but I hope that the way that I sound and the way that, you know, my delivery is not clouding the message, right? Because this ties in with all this idiotic stuff that's going on. I talked about Mississippi specifically because the place is near and dear to my heart. Chicago's got struggles too. And, you know, I'm going to deal with that on another episode some other time. I tried to bring some things out, you know, and having some guests come on from that area, but you know, I'm gonna do things like that. And then I'm gonna have people on that I don't agree with, but I'm gonna give them their point of view because I want you as a listener to hear what those arguments are. And as you know, I can have the latitude to challenge anything they say after they get their points across. But the purpose of this podcast is to engage African-American voters in a way that they will be energized, in a way that they will be articulate in demanding what they need. right? I'm not trying to tell you what you need. I'm just throwing out my vision and hope that you and thousands of others will buy into it, right? Or if not the exact vision, a variation of it. But the ultimate goal is to basically break down and explain that black political power is supposed to mean black economic power. That's the mission. And as long as racism is a major, major factor in us achieving that, maintaining the black political power and achieving black economic power, then America is going to suffer as a whole. And the classic example now, from a national standpoint, is this whole mess with the Speaker of the House. You know, being a member of the Democratic Party is not necessarily the best example of unity and walking in lockstep, right? Will Rogers said years ago, I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And that's true. There are many factions within the Democratic Party, more than just liberal, moderate, conservative, right? And the party has always tried to embrace itself as a big tent and tried to embrace people and their ideas. And then the conventions are really made not for choosing our nominee, because the primaries handle that for us now. But the big highlight of the national Democratic National Convention is shaping the platform. To have all the factions get in the convention and push and try to get this on the platform and that on the platform and debate vigorously why it should or should not be on the platform. I mean, that's really the coolest thing about the National Convention. But, you know, we're at an age now where we literally had the other political party run a candidate for president of the United States, and the convention had no platform. They had no issues, which is an issue in itself, right? Now, they went ahead and carried out an agenda, right? And they got Supreme Court justices in to reverse Roe v. Wade. And, you know, they're getting federal judges on the bench now to try to reverse policies that were designed to protect and give opportunities to black people and other people of color. You know, they're electing people in these state legislatures or pushing people in these state legislatures and in these state houses, these governor's mansions, to run this gamut. And again, this Project 2050, if you haven't read it, read it. Because that's really the blueprint going forward. And the significance of 2050 is, if I haven't told you before, 2040 is supposed to be when the nation flips, according to the consensus, and that white people will be the minority and people of color will be the majority. So they're putting together a plan. So by the time that happens, everything that they wanted to do or want to continue to do, they have the blueprint in place to make it so, right? And it's like, you know, everybody's, you know, they harping on about all these federal jobs that they're going to get rid of, right? And, that, you know, anybody that's serious about budgets and making government effective and all that talks about consolidation of agencies and all that kind of stuff. I've entertained that. If you read my blog, you've seen some ideas I've had. But, you know, the one thing I have to be careful of that obviously these Republicans don't give a damn about is the biggest employer of black people in the United States is government. Right? So, whether it's at the federal level, state level, county level, local level, the biggest employer of African Americans in the United States is the public sector, federal government. I mean, government work at all the levels, right? So if one of the highlights is we're going to get rid of as many federal jobs as we can, right? Then who does that impact more than anybody else? Black folks. Because if the majority of us are working in the public sector, then that's going to impact our wealth. It already impacts our wealth because government jobs have great benefits, but they don't pay salaries like in the corporate world. Right? And so, you know, that's why a lot of people, they get into public service, they try to get into lobbying because they'll make way more money lobbying than they did being a public servant. So because if the majority of black people are working in the public sector, then that means they're not making as much money as people in the private sector, which impacts our wealth, which is why for every $100 a white man has in assets, a black man only has five. Or I should say white person, black person, right? And the whole purpose of black people getting into political power is to change that dynamic from 5 to 50 or 5 to 100. I mean, that's the mission. Again, that's the mission. And so, you know, as long as we allow that to this stuff to happen to us, allow these people to push this idea and not understand the consequences of it, right? Again, if you're black and you want to vote Republican and you buy into dismantling black wealth and you buy into maintaining racist policies to keep black people subjugated, fine. That's on you. I'm not mad at you. I disagree with you. I'll campaign against your candidates. Call it a day. And the crazy thing is that as a black person, I know that black people, in the true sense of the word conservative, are more conservative than anybody else. Because we have traditional values as far as religion. We have a culture that we've developed here that gleans off of things that we remembered or we held on to from our heritage in Africa, that we've incorporated about family and about community and all that. And, you know, we've been indoctrinated enough where those institutions have been weakened. But in a sense, man, homecoming means something, right? Because it's family. You know, we see people that we had a bond with. No matter what crazy stuff we did or whether we was talking about what classes we took or whatever, there's a bond there. And that's familial, right? And so it's important in black communities to have that sense of belonging, to have that camaraderie. And when people try to dismantle that to say the only way you really can be wealthy is you got to cut those folks loose. You know what I'm saying? But anyway, back to these Republicans. So the show that they're putting on now, the division, is impeding our progress in this nation. We can't get stuff done. The government might literally be shut down because these folks can't get their act together to elect a speaker. Right? The rabbit hole I went down about describing Democrats and being, you know, fractional or whatever. The Republicans, you know, weren't always like that. But because they got greedy and because they wanted power so bad, instead of understanding your role like black people have understood their role, right? It's like, yeah, we want to have as much political power as we can attain, but we don't want to bring in the worst elements of our community to attain it. I hope that makes sense, right? And I hope that doesn't sound too exclusionary, but it's like, look at what's happening with the Republicans. This crazy, radical, misguided element that is pervasive, perverse even, right? That just they're just all over the place, you know. I mean, and they have no limits. They have no filters. They have no boundaries. You have a U.S. Congresswoman who literally said, "I believe that Jewish space lasers started wildfires in California." Turn right around and now get on Twitter and say, "I stand with Israel." In what way do you stand with them? You were accusing them of starting fires in our country. Now you're with them in what capacity? Right? I mean, the hypocrisy, the unmitigated gall to just say what's on their mind instead of maybe stepping back and filtering a little bit. And we've put these people in positions of responsibility. And that's crazy to me. And then they wonder why people don't quite get along, or why people don't want to talk about politics and mixed company and all that. I mean, literally, there was a group of people that I was talking to that I knew, and there was a white guy in the conversation, and the name Donald Trump came up, and all of a sudden the white guy just kind of drifted away. That's where we are. We can't even sit up there and defend our politics like we defend our sports teams, right? I'm a Chicago sports fan. This football season's been really rough for me, right? The last two seasons, this one and the last one, it's been really rough for me. But I grew up a Chicago Bears fan, and I will always be a Chicago Bears fan. No matter how rough the season is and all that, I will defend them because I can brag and say this team was literally the founding team or one of the founding teams of the National Football League. More Hall of Famers have played for the Chicago Bears than any other franchise, right? In the Super Bowl era, we've only been to two, but, you know, prior to the Super Bowl era, we won a bunch of national, you know, NFL championships. Our coach was one of the winningest coaches of all time. I could go on, right? But that's an example of standing up for your team, good or bad, right? The Republicans are not like that. And they're definitely not like that when it comes to not only their own party, but the nation that they claim they want to govern. And, you know, it just goes back to the old saying, you know, Maya Angelou and others after her, you know, believe them when they tell you who they are. Because if they run on a campaign saying, I'm basically going to destroy the government, and you elect them, well, look what they're doing. Some of it seems to be intentional, and some of it is a consequence of their inability to govern, given the opportunity. And so now our nation is in flux. We may have another, we may actually have a government shutdown, right? And then we've got the situation in Israel. We've had the situation in Ukraine. And because one political party can't get their act together, we're kind of handicapped. As a matter of fact, because of one particular Republican, Tommy Tuberville, Tuberville, however you want to say it, in Alabama, right? We don't have an envoy to a nation that's at war. We usually had a U.S. envoy to Israel, but because of Tuberville's protest, we don't have one. We should have had that done months ago, along with all the other folks, and, you know, piecemealing it one by one. Now we have a commandant. Now we have a joint chief of staff's chair to replace General Milley, Brother Brown, right? We're starting to get one by one, but the tradition has been, let's get all these people, vote them in one resolution, get it over with, get them sworn in, get them to do the work of protecting our nation and the world that we live in. Tuberville doesn't care about that. He is mad because a woman who is serving our nation decides she doesn't want to have a family at this particular time in her life. She lives in a state which now has been allowed to ban abortion. He's mad that the U.S. military will pay for her to go to a state to get the abortion so that she can come back and serve their interest and serve their nation. He's mad about that. And to the Department of Defense's credit, they're not blinking on that. He's like, well, it's their fault. All this could go away if they would just capitulate to what I want. No, they're not. Because if they capitulate to you, that sends a message to the rest of the world. It's like, oh, man, these jokers are so twisted. We can invade their country or, you know, attack any of their interests at any given moment because they're so twisted as far as their politics. Their politicians don't support the military. Those are perceptions that are out there. And the main reason why we're trying to make sure that, look, this Israel thing, the Hamas attacks, we gotta balance this out before it becomes genocide for both nations. Because Hamas wants to wipe out Israel, period. And according to some people that were tied to the organization at one point, they want to wipe out anything that's not Islamic. Whole other discussion for another day. But right now, Hamas is saying we don't recognize the state of Israel, so we're going to basically try to wipe them out. And Israel, with this far-right government that they have, their thing is collective punishment. We're going to kill every Palestinian because a few Palestinians who are with Hamas attacked us. Can you imagine if we had gone to Afghanistan after 9/11 and just started killing every citizen of Afghanistan, whether they were in the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or not? Literally every one of them. We just bombed Kabul and every major city in Afghanistan relentlessly for a week. How would that look? All right. What we did was, we went to war with Al-Qaeda. We went to war with the Taliban. Of course, we threw Iraq in there too. But even that, it wasn't against the whole nation. It was against the military. We went after military targets. We felt that POWs were taken. We tried to attack the places where they were to rescue them or get them released or at least negotiate a release. Now, I get the we're not going to negotiate with terrorists stuff, all that. So that goes back to the former point that it should be pinpointed attacks, not blanket bombing. And that's why we get into this dichotomy of, oh, well, the Israelis are committing genocide, oh, and the Hamas is, they're terrorists and all that. It's both. It's happening. We got to stop this political Simple Simon game and chew gum and walk at the same time. We got to exercise our brains and say, look, two wrongs don't make a right. Y'all remember that, right? When y'all little two wrongs don't make a right. But anyway, if the United States can't even get an envoy picked because of some senator is on a crusade about something that, you know, he's wrong on the issue anyway, then we're going to have this confusion. We're going to have these people trying to annihilate each other. Oh, and by the way, we still got this country named Russia that's in Ukraine, and we still got to fund them. And oh, we got this other country named China who wants to reclaim Taiwan after they basically kicked them out. You know. So you got all that stuff going on, but if we don't have a functioning government, then we can't address those concerns. And yeah, I understand some of y'all folks that are nationalists, well, we shouldn't be engaged in all that stuff anyway. And we're spending money that should be spent here. Brothers and sisters, I'm going to break this down to you one more again. There is enough money in the United States to feed, clothe, and house homeless people. And we still have enough money to literally fund the war in Ukraine. And still have some change left over to do what else we got to do. We're talking about $6 trillion is the United States budget. Not three, which has always been my operating figure for years. It's six. $6 trillion. You can do a lot with $6 trillion if you have a government that functions. It's a lot of money. A lot of money that you and I pay into. That money doesn't come up. It's not like they just print that separate for the U.S. government. No, that's our money as taxpayers that we give for our government to function. And when we're looking at a political party that is so dysfunctional amongst themselves that they are creating dysfunction in the entire institution of government, then something has to be done. Something has to be said. Actions need to be taken. Folks need to be removed. Right? It's that simple. Either get your act together, or we would like for you to step aside if you can't handle it. But if you don't voluntarily step aside, then we're going to remove you. That's how we do things in a political process. And the removal process is elections. But if you get caught up in all these folks that are talking about, and the vote don't count. Look, man, screw anybody. I don't care if you listen to the podcast or not. You think I'm intelligent or whatever. If you believe that not voting, black people not voting, is an option for you, screw you. I think it's unfair that you get any kind of platform and people like me and others who are pushing for us to exercise the very right that we literally died for, right? Our leaders got killed and beat up and all that stuff. And you want to be cavalier about it, screw you. We need to vote in each and every election, and we need to be educated about it. And right now, ladies and gentlemen, the education that you see is that there is a political party that's not ready to govern. And they should not be rewarded in any way, shape, or form. Until they get their act together, they're not a viable option for us. Now, do we have to challenge against the party that will receive our votes, taking it for granted? Yes, we always have to deal with that. We always have to be vigilant with that. We don't want anybody to take our vote for granted. But I do think that you need to earn it. And showing me that you're dysfunctional is not showing that you are worthy of it. Right? So, like I said, man, I didn't want to get into it too much, but I had to say something. This whole crap that's going on in Washington with the speaker's race and just these folks that we got members that don't even know the basic concept of the scarlet letter. I had a woman show up at a meeting talking about, I got my scarlet letter on. You don't even know what the symbol of that means. You wanted to apply it to something political, and it's like it's a character assassination on yourself, and you don't even know that. That the level of ignorance is mind-blowing. And people that are not prepared should not be in. If you're a fan of sports, you don't want your team not prepared to play. You don't want a team that doesn't practice. You don't want a team that doesn't study film. You don't want a team like that. You want a team that knows their responsibilities, know what they're supposed to do, and they're able to execute the plan. That's what you want, right? So if you want that in your sports, why would you not want that in something that you really have invested in, which is your government? Because you may not go to a game because of them prices. You may not subscribe to the NFL Network or the NBA TV or whatever. You may not do all that. You may not even subscribe. You have a choice to subscribe to ESPN. But you got to pay your taxes. You got to pay that. So since I got to pay that, and I get to decide through my vote who gets to operate that, gets to utilize that money, who gets to regulate that money, who gets to appropriate that money, right? Then I demand excellence, not idiocrity, not mediocrity, excellence. Now, if you want both sides and say, well, Democrats are not excellent, bruh, compared to what the other side is, they're almost looking like perfection right now. And I know that's not true. But the Democrats understand we've got a job to do. The Republicans think it's a game. And not a game like sports, a game like life or operation. This is just for fun. There's no consequences to what we do. And the only way that's going to stop is that we don't vote for them anymore. That we don't support that. And then maybe a little old town like Jackson, Mississippi might have a chance. A city like Atlanta and Georgia might have a chance. A city like Chicago, Illinois might have a chance. A country like the United States of America might have a chance. But we've got to be responsible. We got to be vigilant. And we've got to have no tolerance for foolishness anymore. All right, guys, that's it. Until next time.